So, I recently navigated to the Twitter page of number 10 Downing Street, the office of the British Prime Minister, and I immediately saw something terribly wrong with it. I'll see if you can spot what I mean. Let's go to the next one. The answer is, of course, that there's no British aesthetics on display. I pointed this out on Twitter and was surprised by the strength of the reaction. You've got a Ukraine flag, okay? Like, you've got an LGBT flag. I'm not actually making any statement here about whether those are good or bad or whether you should or shouldn't support them, but what I'm saying is there's no British aesthetics there. Right? You would expect something British about 10 Downing Street. Mm. Anyway. So, more particularly, there were a few comments from leftists, from Irish nationalists, and so on, along the lines of, what is British aesthetics, LMFAO? Like, what is it? And I was just staggered by this response. The implication, of course, is that Britain has no culture, has no aesthetic identity, no nothing. And I think that's an incredibly racist position. What do you think?
Well, I don't know about Irish nationalists with the same race, aren't we? But they certainly, we live in their mind rent-free, mm-hmm. don't we?
Oh, that's
they've got a massive chip on their shoulder, a lot of them, about mm-hmm. England and about London. Mm. It's the root of all evil.
I found that a lot of the people making these assertions would have, say, trans flags in the bio, LGBT flags, race pride flags, EU flags, pronouns in the bio, the usual suspects.
Suffering from mental illness. Yeah.
But one thing I found really curious was that they didn't argue the same thing about non-British aesthetics. So that there's Japanese aesthetics, for example. You look at that, right? Anyone can look at that and say, oh, yeah, that's Japan. Like, obviously, that's Japan. And stick a Mount Fuji in the background, and where else could it be? Hmm. People talk about Ukrainian aesthetics as well. You look at these coins and things with the trident. Yeah, that's obviously Ukraine, as we now all know. We're very familiar with Ukrainian aesthetics now, more than we were 6 months ago. There's Native American aesthetics, right? You've got your teepee tents, your feather headdresses. Obviously, my knowledge of Native American aesthetics is not very advanced, but I can look at that and say, oh, yeah, that's Native Americans. Mm. There's Maori aesthetics. You know, all of these are aesthetics that these people would never dream of criticizing. You know?
No. It's just us.
No.
It comes from a place of just pure resentment, I think. Mm-hmm. Nothing more than that. It's nothing really to do with reality or anything.
I think
it's just how can we run down people I've got a chip on my shoulder about? Mm. It's just as simple as that. Any lie will do.
Well, I think it's a bit more complicated than that. I think there are people who are genuinely being raised in this country to try and forget the fact that Britain has a cultural identity. And I think that they've succeeded with a lot of these people. Like, the very phrase British aesthetics seemed to be shocking to a lot of people. And even people who were in favour of the point that I was making didn't, a lot of them didn't seem to look further than the flag when I was talking about aesthetics. There's a lot more to it than the flag. There's no flag here, for example. But you look at this and you're not like, oh, yeah, that's Basildon. No, that's right. That's New Zealand, mm-hmm. obviously. We go to the next one. Zulu aesthetics. Again, very strong identity. Mark that out straight away. And there's even queer aesthetics. Yeah. Very strange to see that flag in such numbers along the streets. But and John Crow, who does our voice readings, very accurately points out that the leftist reactions to these two streets were quite revealing. So this demonstrates that the same people who come out to sneer at British aesthetics will wave the flag for any other cultural group, I think. Yeah. So I thought we could spend some time looking at examples of British aesthetics and really celebrate some of the things which make us British, which we can enjoy as scions of an ancient and worthy culture. By the time this video is over, you should have Britishness leaking out of your eyeballs. So just to get us started, I've got a short clip to play. Let's just take a moment to enjoy this scene, which I argue is, in its own way, one of the most British scenes of all time, ever. Let's go.
Is this Jeeves and Wooster? I haven't seen this before.
Can you hear the audio?
Yeah.
Thank you. morning, sir.
Ow, Jeeves.
Your tea, sir.
Oh, thank you, Jeeves.
Did you find that a peculiar choice?
not really. No, I mean, it's got a lot there, isn't it? Our love of tea, if nothing else.
There's no flag there. There's no national symbols. There's no icons. Nothing. So what about that is British?
Well, Fryer. Stephen okay, Fryer and Hugh Laurie. Yeah. But of course, the cup of tea, the English. Mm-hmm. The countryside, the cottage, yeah. Mm-hmm. All sorts of things.
There's also a nod to British stoicism there with him sleeping in this barn. The cottage is burned out in the background from the last night's events. He's got what looks like a devastating hangover. And then there's Jeeves just sort of stoically persevering, making tea in extremely adverse conditions, doing it properly, milking the cow and so on and so forth. And then you also have the manservant and relationship there, the old feudal nod, so to speak, from the 1920s. And I just think that is quintessentially British.
Mm.
But more than that is the music. Mm. The music is an original soundtrack that's made. You know, it's modern British culture. It's not something dragged out of hundreds of years in the past. And it's based heavily on Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending.
Oh, okay, right.
Which has that very characteristic sort of rising violin in it.
No, I love that song.
It's one of my most favourite, and it's the most British piece of music ever made, I think. But it's 16 minutes long, and I couldn't find anywhere to put it in, which is sad, because I would love to share that with you. And if you enjoy this podcast, go and listen to that classical piece.
It's... Do you know what I always think? I always think, in a sort of perverse way, it's kind of Japanese-y.
Really?
Yeah, and The Lark Ascending, just because it's sort of, I don't know, maybe so technically great and kind of beautiful sounding, no way to, it for whatever reason, like I say, it doesn't really make sense, but in my mind, obviously it couldn't be further from Japanese, but something in my mind just makes that connection.
I think the the prominence of the solo instrument perhaps is what, but I'd have to think about that later.
Okay,
but there's a lovely story with The Lark Ascending. So there's a virtuoso violinist called Hilary Hahn, and when she was touring playing The Lark Ascending, she came to England. Performed in a concert in some lovely old English church somewhere. And then this old gentleman gets up afterwards and he's like, by the way, have you ever actually seen A Lark Ascending? And she's like, no, I haven't. Would you like to come and see one? So they go out and a few days later and they sit in the field and they just watch the lark taking off. And when a lark first learns to fly, they sort of circle the meadow again and again and again. And it's sort of a fitful attempt. And then they is eventually fly off. And that's what this 16-minute piece really describes. So it's really, in every way possible, just woven into the imagery and the culture of Britain.
Yeah, it really is a lovely piece. I mean, I could listen to it. I could put it on just quietly in the background while I'm studying or reading something else or something. Yes. It's really, really lovely.
And I often do. I listened to it on the bus on the way in this morning, and I've had a very serene morning, I must say. So this leads us into classical music, and there's plenty of British classical music. There's Elgar, of course. There's Vaughan Williams, who wrote that. Elgar wrote the Enigma Variations and set Land of Hope and Glory to music, I believe. There's Gustav Holst, who wrote the Planet Symphony. And it doesn't sound like a British name, of course, but he's a British composer. And he wrote The Planets, which he's most famous for, but also other works. Thomas Tallis, Benjamin Britten, plenty of names that you can recall that. But of course, we only have an hour to get through all of this. So yes, there we go. Land of Hope and Glory, the Proms. You know what we're talking about here. So it's a really patriotic anthem. Everyone in the Royal Albert Hall in late September, I believe, sings this song, and it's really quite impactful. But a great litmus test for whether something is a British aesthetic or not is whether some rancid ideologue at the BBC or The Guardian has tried to cancel it.
All right.
Do you recall that this was essentially taken off the programme at the last night of the Proms in response to the George Floyd blah, 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 blah? Mad. And only with a great deal of public pressure was it put back on. And in the similar vein, we have this sort of no Britishness, please, we're British angle, which often comes out of The Guardian. So no flag waving, please, we're British. And it's very sort of using your own weapons against you, sort of snarky judo move. If you scroll down here, if you just Google that, as I did, You've got loads of articles. Why the English don't like flag waving. Brexit Britain's flag waving politics is a symbol of its decline. European Parliament speaker scolds Brexit MPs for waving the flag. And so on and so forth. The hidden danger of the UK's flag obsession. Waving a flag and saying Great Global Britain is an empty gesture. Rise in Union Jack flag waving is a sign of deep anxiety. And it goes on.
The
and
Irish
on
Times,
and
the
on.
Telegraph, the Guardian, Reuters, something on Facebook.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, those people that have got a problem with our flags, like, I don't know, off the top of my head, Emily Thornberry or Naga Manchetti or anyone like that, they've lost their mind. They're suffering from a type of a perverse madness, an inverted weirdo madness. And I want nothing to do with it. I find it absolutely disgusting.
No, I agree.
Simple as that. It's just as simple as that.
But there's so much more to Britishness and British aesthetics than the flag. Right, but I really think that
of course
we need to realise that this, oh no, we're British, we can't be patriotic thing, we don't do that sort of thing, is a really poisonous argument. And as we go through the immense cultural heritage of this, of these isles, I think you'll gradually start to understand what I mean by that. So, speaking of music, we also have the Fab Four. I can't really play anything here in this section due to copyright, but you can feel free to go home in your own time and, you know, put the gramophone on and listen to some great British music. So I don't need to explain the Beatles. It would be insulting to try. We also have Led Zeppelin, another of my great favourites. When the Levee Breaks, just what a tune.
I always think of a funny clip when the Beatles touched down in America and a reporter said to them, shouldn't you have a haircut? Shouldn't you get a haircut? I think it was Ringo. Ringo or George said, I've just had one, actually. I thought it was a great comeback.
Yeah. It's pretty good. speaking of haircuts, I mean, Led Zeppelin back in the day, it'd stand out today, wouldn't they?
That's a Barnett and a half, isn't it?
Yeah. Pink Floyd as well were very much into this fashion, as you can see there. And Pink Floyd are known for their very sort of almost philosophical concerts, I would say. They're very grand, but they're not the sort of thing that you necessarily want to rave to. They're probably my favourite musical group of all time. But, they're just, you have to go away and listen to the sound, and it's very much of its time. The Division Bell is a later album, but one of my favourites, I think. And some of the video imagery that comes along with that. Well, we shall have to get into that afterwards. And then, of course, there is Oasis from the 90s, which Josh and Thomas did a podcast on, just going through the rise and fall, the story of them, because they were central to the Britpop movement. And I think that's actually quite controversial, because this was a whole movement in which you could argue that these singers were like wrapping themselves in the Union Jack and so on and so forth. Not really to say Britain is great, perhaps, but to just cash in on the aesthetics and the appeal of those. Yeah. It's one opinion, of course.
Plus back then, because I lived through this. Yeah. Sort of 94, 95, 96, I was like in year 10 and 11 sort of age. So I was primed to be an Oasis and or Blur fan. And it wasn't anything to do with being overly patriotic or anything. It had nothing to do with that. It's just that no one really had a chip on their shoulder about the Union Jack.
Right,
or particularly. I mean, some did, of course, but mostly not. There's mostly no problem with displaying the Union Jack or the St. George's flag or St. George's Cross or anything like that. So it wasn't like an overt statement of nationalism or anything like that. It was just that there's no problem with doing this. I'm totally happy to be British.
It's
kind of as simple as that.
There's a kind of self-affirming thing to that movement as well, isn't there?
Right,
You know, you wave the flag of your own country, and it's not necessarily a form of state worship. It's just, you know, this is me, and it is part of me, and I like it.
I'm not ashamed. I'm not embarrassed. You know, in the recent Jubilee, there was a couple of articles where people said, mostly Muslim people, I see one article where they said, you know, it's like a living hell having to see the bunting around everywhere. It's like, you're in the wrong country then, I'm afraid.
There's not barbed wire on the flags. It is as simple as
that, right, yeah. It is as simple as that. There's something broken in your mind, or you're best off somewhere else.
So I do think British music has a distinctive sound. It is stronger with some groups than others, and I think it's hard to put your finger on when you listen to, but you do listen to something and you're like, yeah, that's British music. Can't really say what it is, but it's there.
It's funny how at least English language music dominates the world. You go to somewhere on the other side of the world and they're playing American or British songs.
Yeah.
It's like, I know, two or three French language songs ever. you know, La Bamba. I know a couple of Spanish language songs.
99 Luftballon.
Oh, yeah. So there's one German language song that's of any note.
A satellite from Eurovision.
But I think it is a bit surprising, you know, when you go on holiday and it's just whatever's playing on our radios.
Mm, generally.
They play wherever you go in the world. So
I mean, in Korea and Japan, they generally... especially Korea, they tend to play more indigenous songs. But like the smash hits of America, you'll hear Taylor Swift, for example, or you used to walking around Korea and Japan. Not so much Korea. It has an immense cultural influence, British and American music. Mm. But just with that distinctive sound, I remember when I was in Cambridge, there was a fellow who used to come in who was a very proud Scottish nationalist. And every time he was running the bar, you'd have nothing but Scottish music from start to finish. You'd get a bit sick of it after a while. But it was just something that you could note distinctively. Huh, that's Scottish music. Don't know why I know that. They're not even like speaking in Scots right now, but I know that's Scottish music from the sound.
How much is it? Well, the Proclaimers? Who else is
there? Was a bit of the Proclaimers. There's Churches, a bit more recent. Quite a few, actually, but I can't remember.
Biffy Clyro. Anyway.
But it's not just music, of course. We have an opera tradition.
Mm.
Which many people might be surprised to know. When you think of opera, you think Vienna, Austria, Italy, Germany, and so on. But we have Gilbert and Sullivan, which are a bit of a thing unto themselves. Mm. This is an original poster from back in that era. You can see it's got lavish costumes. Even in musical theatre in university, Gilbert and Sullivan is kind of a subculture. There's a certain group of people who do and like Gilbert and Sullivan. The people who do it are often the people who go and watch it, and they're a real subculture.
Right.
Almost like the punk movement, but far less cool.
Yeah.
And if we see a modern performance in the next one, it's just quite lavish, quite good fun, and very much speaks to that contemporary Victorian aesthetic in the lyricism, like the word games, I am the very model of a modern major general, and so on.
Is that HMS Pinafore or something?
I believe so, yeah.
I only know that from the from the Simpsons episode when... he gets Sideshow Bob to perform all of HMS Pinafore to waste time. Anyway.
But that's, it's something where, yes, there's this cultural osmosis that's going on there, but a lot more people know I am the very model of a modern major general, or the derivative parody lampoon versions of it, than know Gilbert and Sullivan. But it is a thing that's worth remembering. And then, of course, there's the Royal Opera House, where even if a lot of the time it's performing... you know, as Jim Hacker from Yes Minister would say, French, German, Italian pieces. It's still a living operatic culture right there.
Mm, mm.
And just look at the architecture of that building. That's sumptuous, isn't it? Have you been there yourself at all?
No, I haven't, no. You know, I'm a bit of a culture vulture, but not opera.
Mm.
It's one of the things. I've been to see one opera once, like 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I quite enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really follow it because it wasn't in English. Can't even remember what one it was now.
Mm.
Yeah, quite enjoyed it, but it's not. I wasn't sort of raised with it particularly.
Course. But that's the thing. Like, I'm not into opera. My grandfather was, despite not being at all of the social milieu you would expect to be an opera fan. That was his hobby.
Oh, right.
He ran a store. He was a greengrocer, and he listened to opera, and that was basically him in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, it's funny that opera is European-wide sort of a phenomenon in a way, because it's stretched for so many centuries,
mm-hmm.
sort of unchanged in some ways, across all sorts of nations, all sorts of languages.
Mm.
And I was listening to a historian. It's funny, I had no idea this was going to come up.
Mm.
But about a week ago, I was listening to a historian talking about sort of the phenomenon of opera. There's no rational reason why it would be so successful, so to speak, for so long across such a vast area, there's no rhyme or reason why opera, of all the of all the ways to express yourself,
the dramatic forms, the live performance,
especially as most people don't know what they're looking at or hearing exactly.
Yeah, you almost have to have an explainer most of the time before you understand what's going on in order to appreciate it.
And yet people spend a fair bit of money and a whole evening doing that.
And there's the connoisseurist side of it, the same sort of people who collect wine and cigars and so on. They engage with opera in the same way, I think.
Yeah.
There's that class too.
Yeah.
But the point I'm trying to make here is you don't have to be absorbed into all of these cultural activities. You don't have to be singing Gilbert and Sullivan in your spare time and going to the opera on weekends. Most people aren't. The vast majority of people aren't. What I'm trying to put across is that this is in the water. This is Britishness. It's there swimming, circulating all around you, and you kind of don't consciously notice it.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.